From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. There's a new trend, still early days, but experts say it's growing, on construction sites, on the highway and more, boomer men graying out of classic tough guy blue-collar jobs. Not enough millennial guys stepping up to replace them. To the rescue, women. Union bosses, truck fleet owners, and more are reaching out to women to fill those jobs. The Iron Workers Union has started offering fast-track apprenticeships and up to 8 months maternity leave. Iron Workers, this hour On Point, wooing women workers into hard hats and big rigs. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you seeing more women on your construction site, running 18-wheelers down the interstate? And how are those jobs, those sites, those roads for women? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Here's a little bit from an announcement in San Diego late last month at an ironworkers conference. The union here saying it's a worker development organization will now offer paid maternity leave to women ironworkers. The voice you hear is that of the ironworkers, Vicki O'Leary.
Impact and the ironworkers are excited and pleased to announce that the ironworkers now have a maternity leave policy for qualified women ironworkers. This again makes Impact and the ironworkers the trailblazers in the construction industry by rolling out a maternity leave policy for our women ironworkers.
Woo! There you've got it. Ironworkers very enthusiastic about this. We found a video on YouTube. This is posted by the Pacific Northwest Ironworkers chapter, where they ask an unnamed woman apprentice in the field about the job.
It is physically demanding. I'm not going to deny that, but you go and work out at the gym, well, this is like an eight-hour gym. Every day when you finally see what you've done and you build all this beam, you build this wall, it's amazing. And then you come back next week and it's got cement and it's getting formed and it's becoming a building. And it's wonderful to be part of it.
Like an eight-hour gym, and employers really pushing for this. Unions, too, there. Later in this hour, we're going to look at the fight between Canada and the U.S. over lumber tariffs. But first, women being wooed into jobs that were traditionally pushed toward men. Joining me now from Washington is Danielle Paquette, economic policy reporter for The Washington Post. Her article, which caught our eye, is headlined, America's Manliest Industries Are All Competing for Women. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Danielle, welcome back to On Point.
Happy to be here.
What is happening that's driving this?
So it's interesting. As you guys pointed out, baby boomers are retiring in these massive numbers. They're leaving construction sites, body shops, 18-wheelers, all of these industries that have been traditionally male-dominated. And at the same time, young men are not rushing forward to fill these roles at the rate they once did. So the ironworkers and other leaders in these industries are tapping this sort of underutilized pool of talent, and that would be women. One of the first steps we're seeing is adding this family-friendly benefit. It's one of the most generous in the trades and in the country, really.
So boomers, okay, boomer guys who have been doing these jobs, I don't know, welding and ironworking and truck driving and all the rest, retiring. Millennial guys don't want those jobs, or they're not stepping. What about middle-aged? I mean, we've heard for years that we had an underemployment. I mean, the whole election last fall, we were told, was because there weren't enough white working-class jobs, and forget white, just working-class jobs out there. It's confusing when you first hear this.
Right. It's counterintuitive. Well, we know that based on census data that about a fifth of the U.S. population is reaching retirement age by 2029. And millennials, they just aren't as interested in pursuing careers in the trades. You see this with fewer numbers enrolling in trade schools. Construction jobs, meanwhile, are holding steady. You know, we're hiring people at about the same rate we were 10 years ago, seasonally ticking up and down. But the blue-collar work that you heard about vanishing during the campaign season, that's more manufacturing. So in reality, we have all of these roles and fewer people. And that's complicated. Some of this is because of students who feel pressure to go to college, or maybe they're going to the tech field where maybe their father and their father's generation might have gone into construction. And there's also issues like the opioid epidemic, which is knocking out some of this workforce, making them unable to pass drug tests. So employers are scratching their heads like, well, we have so few women in our ranks. This is such a massive group of workers. What can we do to make our environment more friendly to them?
and jobs that you just didn't see opened quickly to women for a long time, maybe opening now. Danielle Paquette, please stand by in Washington. Lots of callers already on this. Brenda in Wakanda, Illinois. Brenda, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to commend on the topic. I think it's very nice that you guys are talking about this, and it just brings a lot of memories to me because I actually worked and grew up. My dad was a construction worker and owned a trucking company in the construction field.
Yeah.
And he hired a lot of owner-operators. And when they didn't show to job sites, there was times where my older sister would actually have to go. And my dad had taught her how to drive the cars and got her CL driver's license in Southern California and would actually go out there on the job sites with my dad.
And what about now? Do you see more women who are, I mean, it sounds like he's running dump trucks or something. Do you have women in the driver's seat?
Yes, plenty. You see that all the time. And then, you know, you're driving down the street and you see the women holding the stop signs. And it brings a smile to my face. It's really nice to see the women out there. And it's very empowering.
Yeah, terrific. Brenda, and it runs in the family. Sisters jumping in when it was needed. And now a whole industry is looking to women to make this happening. What's the reaction? What's the response, Danielle Paquette, with the Washington Post? Are women saying, yeah, give me the hard hat, give me the steel-toed boots, I'm ready?
You know, it's still early. You know, today, less than 10% of all construction workers are female. For truckers, that's 2%. So the efforts will have to be watching to see how they attract women. Historically, women who've worked in these manly industries, you know, surrounded by all men, encounter more issues with sexual harassment, according to research, or they might find that their male coworkers or bosses might doubt their ability simply because they are women. And so groups like the Iron Workers are responding from the very top with messages like, hey, you do belong here. We do want you. And here is this expensive, very generous benefit to keep you around.
Talking about maternity benefits there, and it's hard to overstate just what a marked change this is. You tell the story of Bridget Booker in your Washington Post piece, who was working in Peoria, Illinois, and got pregnant, was afraid to tell her boss because what was she doing? And remind us what happened there.
So women in these male-dominated fields, construction, like Bridget, sometimes they feel pressure to downplay their femininity, kind of erase any difference they might have between them and their colleagues. Bridget wanted to hide her pregnancy so no one would doubt her ability to do her job. She ended up miscarrying while she was working on a bridge project in Peoria, and that can be a very traumatic thing. And painful physically.
Yeah, I mean, on the job. Here she is she was covering up her pregnancy with the baggy coveralls. I mean, trying to not take a day off, basically, before she had the baby. And she lost the baby on the job.
Well, she lost the baby when she was home. Mm-hmm. But she took one day off, and then she was back out there on the construction site as though nothing happened. She didn't want to lose pay, and she also didn't want her coworkers to doubt her dedication to her livelihood.
She called in sick when she lost the baby and was back at work less than 48 hours later. You quote her saying, "I did it to survive. As a woman in the trade, you have to prove yourself every day. Not a day goes by that you don't have to let them know that you're up for the task." She stood up at a construction conference in Chicago and told this story. What was the reaction, Danielle?
Well, the reaction was the union leadership. They were touched by this. When I talked to the president, Eric Dean, he told me that he wanted to find a solution to that problem. Because if a woman doesn't feel comfortable even telling people this major deal that's happening in her life, she's going to give birth or she loses a baby. If she's not comfortable being herself, why would other women want to rush into this field? And so they came up with this idea. They're hoping to attract more women.
It's ironic because if you look back to World War II, everybody knows the story. So many men went off to war and so many women went into factory and heavy industrial jobs in the factories. Rosie the Riveter was kind of the icon for that time to encourage and celebrate women in those roles. And they did that work. They churned out the armaments for that enormous war effort. And then after the war, a lot of those were really pulled away from women again, Danielle.
Right. And not until the 90s did women even have the a guarantee that they could take a single day off work without losing their job after the birth of a child. You know, this is fairly recently in our history that we've supported women in any jobs. But, you know, when we're talking about male-dominated jobs, leaders of the industry, they might not have realized how important or essential it is to update their job policies.
Is there a double whammy here? You say millennials are not as interested in this work. I want to examine that when we come back. But what about immigration policy changing as well? Are they worried that they're just, that they're not, you know, there's been a lot of labor that's come in from outside the country. Are they worried about that evaporating?
It's complicated, you know. So much of our immigration policy, our thoughts about the international community, they're up in the air. People are just sort of waiting to see what's going to happen, and that includes employers.
There we are. Kind of an incredible picture. Are women responding? Are they showing up? Is it still too early to say?
You know, I'm hearing from women in trucking in particular, there are now female, quote, female liaisons, female driver liaisons at certain trucking companies to help women both take those jobs and then smooth their transitions. There's support groups I've heard of called, quote, highway diamonds, you know, and over the last year, that particular industry, trucking, saw women drivers increase from 6% to about 7%. So, which is more growth than they'd seen in previous years.
Still down in single digits, but
right.
A situation there that has unions and more looking for women in traditionally male-dominated jobs, iron worker, truck driver, now being promoted to women as men retire or sort of drift off from those industries. Behind us right here, Rosie the Riveter from The Four Vagabonds. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
All the day long, whether rain or shine, she's a part of the assembly line. She's making history, working for victory. Rosie the Riveter keeps a sharp lookout for sabotage. Sitting up there on the fuselage, that little frail can do more than a male can do. Rosie the Riveter. Rosie's got a boyfriend, Charlie. Charlie, he's a Marine. Rosie is protecting Charlie, working overtime on the riveting machine. When they gave her a production knee, she was as proud as a girl could be. There's something true about red, white, and blue about Rosie the Riveter.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about traditionally male-dominated jobs, iron worker, truck driver, blue collar, now being promoted to women as men retire or drift off. You can join us this hour. Are you seeing more women in hard hats or behind the wheel of big rigs? Are you in a traditional, mainly man trade and seeing the need to get in more women to get the jobs done? Is this you, the new Rosie the Riveter, steel-toed boots, leather gloves? How's the work site? Is it working for you? What brought you in? Were you recruited as a woman into the field? Iron workers really pushing on this. Here's a little video, again, from the Pacific Northwest District Council of the Iron Workers called Lady of Iron. They're interviewing a young female iron worker on a construction site.
It's freaking fabulous. They offer retirement. The pay is well. I can build up whatever, you know, what I need. I can buy my own house, you know, just bought a new truck to make myself comfortable and make my life where I want it to be, you know. I would recommend this for any woman who likes to work hard.
And there, you can hear they're pushing hard with these videos. Here's a little more from that woman.
There's a lot of women out there stuck in $10 an hour jobs because they're afraid to come out here in a field full of guys. They think it's all dominated by men, and it's really not. Nobody gives me a hard time out here. The contractors are nice. The other companies we work with are great. You know, everybody treats everybody well, and you're an equal. When you're on this job, you're an equal.
We'll test that. We'll look at it. We want to hear your experience as well. Danielle Paquette has written all this up for the Washington Post. You can link to her story at our website, onpointradio.org. She joins us from Washington. We're going to hear from the Iron Workers Union in just a moment, from truckers as well. But a couple of calls right here. David in Tulsa, Oklahoma. David, thank you for calling. What do you see out there?
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I see a lot. I'm driving right now, but when I go through construction, I do see women out there working right along with the men. But I've been doing this for 38 years, trucking, and I see a lot more women into trucking. That's good because a lot of people retire because of pay. They don't want to stay in it. There ain't no pay in it, you know. It takes 3 years to make up. What, from 43 cents, and you're still behind on payments on everything.
Yeah.
You know, that's the whole economy thing is the pay. And I do like women out there working in construction. You know, they can do the job as same as a man. They should be paid as same as a man.
Yeah,
that's the way I see life.
David, I really appreciate your call, and you be safe with your driving right there. I know you will. Danielle, it's kind of ironic. David said, yeah, they're welcome to it. It doesn't pay well. I mean, but he is welcoming women, but at the same time saying some of these jobs men are getting out because they just don't pay.
Well, you know, he brings up an interesting point here. Women, I'm hearing, are joining trucking because it's guaranteed the same amount of pay as their male colleagues receive. They're paid by the mile or by the load.
Yep.
And honestly, these jobs are paying better than retail. They're paying better than a lot of female-dominated fields. And so you see a number of women rushing in like, yes, I want these larger paychecks, and I want to know that I'm on parity with my male coworkers.
Mm-hmm. Stacy in Colfax, Wisconsin. Stacy, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I started driving truck back in 1994 as a third-generation driver. I give kudos to every lady out there. I ran from flats to vans to sand trucks, gravel trucks out in North Dakota.
Yeah.
My boss right now, out of 7 employees, 3 of us are women. And I see women driving every day. Back in 1994, the only women you used to see in a truck was with their husbands. And most of them didn't drive. Everywhere I went, they're like, oh, gosh, you're the first lady truck driver we ever seen. And now it's every forklift driver. It's you go to a factory to deliver or pick up. They're in there. They're, you know, on the rollers, paving the roads and doing jobs just like them is me because I have a good driving record and been driving for over 20 years.
Yeah.
My last 3 jobs, I actually make more money than the other men that have been doing the same job because I've got the record to prove that they can trust me as an employee and I'm going to get the job done.
What do you think about this trend, Stacy, of more women driving the big rigs, driving the trucks in the plants when you get there on the forklifts? How do you look at it?
I think it's great. I mean, it's a job just like any other job. It does not pay as well as people think it pays. We're away from our families. Even if we're home every night, we're still working 12 hours a day. Besides the commute, it's not an easy thing. You don't barely have time to stop and take a break for lunch in most industries.
Yeah. It's tough.
And I've worked in a warehouse. And half the women there are half the people there are women, I mean.
Lots of women on the job around you, Stacy, and I really appreciate your call as well. Danielle Paquette, I want to get some of these union leaders in here to interrogate them a little bit on what they're looking for and why. Eric Dean joins us right now from Naples, Florida. He is general president of the Iron Workers Union, formerly known as the International Association of Bridge, Structural, Ornamental, and Reinforcing Iron Workers Union. He's also on the executive council of the AFL-CIO and the governing board of the presidents of International Building Trades. Eric Dean, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And with us from Waupaca, Wisconsin, Ellen Voya is here. She's president of the Women in Trucking Association. Ellen Voya, thank you for joining us today.
Hello, Tom.
Eric, first to you. What is driving you guys to put on such a push to get women into your field?
Well, as was discussed previously, the baby boomers were set to leave around 2008 and continuing to leave through 2024. So we recognized that we had to resupply the workforce with our existing membership, and we had to grow. I became president about 2 years ago. And we went under the opportunity to take a look at our union, and I thought we were really improving on being a more diverse and welcoming community, but we could do so much more. So I hired the first full-time international representative, 30-year member in Miss Vicki O'Leary, which you had
we
her
heard
on tape
her.
Before,
yep.
to improve our diversity. So one of the things we started doing was just networking with our incumbent members and talking about what the challenges were to become members and how we saw opportunities. And it's just a natural fit. We need anyone who's able and willing to come and enter into our workforce. We have the ability to train and stand up and recruit, and it was a natural fit that we weren't recruiting enough women in previous era, and I wanted to change that culture about our organization.
So there's a commitment to diversity there, and I get that. That's great. We're a diverse country, and that's great. But the way Danielle tells the story here in the Washington Post, it was also a matter of need. You've got people retiring, and you weren't getting enough job applicants to fill the ranks. And just help us understand that. Where are the millennials in this? Where are millennial guys who might, or middle-aged guys who might naturally come right along behind the boomers and fill those jobs, Eric?
They're there, but they're not there at a larger number. If you look at the social sciences, you'll see there's far more baby boomers leaving the workforce than there are millennials to take their place. So to do it smartly, we have to expand our horizon and footprints on how we're recruiting. And we are competing, as you had indicated earlier, with the industry or standard norm that you had to go to college to be successful. And we wanted to tell people that there was a meaningful and well-paid career. Your driver before, he talked about that construction doesn't pay well. I would tend to defy that logic. And the iron workers working under a collective bargaining agreement, there's equal pay for women in our organization. And our members are well paid because we bargain fairly with our employers and make sure our workers are adequately compensated. So the workers, the women, they understand that. And they want a fair shot. And they want the same pay as a man. And they deserve it.
Ellen Voya, you're there in Wisconsin, Women in Trucking Association president, a regular guest host on Freewheelin' and the David Nemo Show on Sirius XM Radio on the Road Dog channel. Why is trucking reaching out to women, or is it? Is it reaching out very deliberately, Ellen?
Oh, very much so. Right now, there's a shortage of qualified drivers, and just like all of the trades, I mean, we're looking at filling seats that boomers are leaving. And with the new restrictions on health, and you have to be qualified physically and sleep apnea and all those things. And so it's a physically demanding job to a certain point, and a lot of boomers are leaving. But the trucking industry is looking at ways to bring more women in because they're realizing that women can do the job, and women are actually very well suited to doing the job. As a driver, you want someone who doesn't take risks. And women are more risk-averse than men. So and when you see a female in the seat of that big rig, you can feel safer because you know that she's more risk-averse and more safety-conscious than her male peers. So we're looking at filling seats with many more women. I think we could make up, as Danielle said, we're about 7% right now, and there's no reason why we couldn't hit 50%.
50% of American truck drivers, women, in what period? I mean, they say that they're going to be self-driving trucks out there at some point, Ellen. You better hurry.
I don't. You know, that's a good point, Tom. I think that the people outside of the trucking industry look at trucks and they see diesel engines and smokestacks. And now with the advent of autonomous vehicles, and people don't realize how much technology is in the truck.
Yep.
And so the position of a truck driver isn't what people typically think. It's not, you don't have to be physically, you know, a huge, big guy anymore because there's so much automation in the truck. Everything from automated transmissions to air ride, everything, and technology outside the truck that makes it much easier. And carriers are working really hard to get drivers home more so they're not out for weeks at a time like they used to be. And when you see on the back of a trailer it says no-touch freight, it means that the driver's not having to unload anymore. So they're basically driving. And just like in the steelworkers, women, female drivers make the exact same amount of money as their male peers. It's based on the mile or the load or the percentage or whatever. So there's no pay inequity in the trucking industry for drivers.
You know, the first time I came out to the East Coast on my own was on a big rig full of hogs out of Peoria, Illinois, headed for Philadelphia. I was up in the passenger seat, and you see there's a lot going on up there. That is a lot to take care of all at one time. Respect to truck drivers. Stephanie in Houston, Texas. Stephanie, you're on the air.
Well, hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. What's your story?
I've been a truck driver for 37 years with a major company, and I work with Ellen. I am one of the women liaisons that is mentoring the new generation coming up into trucking. And, you know, women need to see someone actually doing the job to realize that they can do it. And I'm going to echo Ellen that you don't have to be big and brawny. You just have to have a knowledge of the work. You have to have good attention to detail. And she's right. We don't take a lot of risks.
You know, we're the perfect drivers out here.
Is it a good job, Stephanie? I mean, we've talked to truck drivers over the years who, many of them like it, but a lot of them sometimes feel kind of like slaves to the wheel and the pay not that great and tough hours, long time away from family.
You know, that must be my personality because there's people that stay and people that go, and I'm a person that wants to go. Yes, I've missed some family functions. But the trade-off was is it gave me financial independence. You know, I was able to provide for my family. There's more positives than negatives, and it's been a grand adventure. You know, it's still going on.
Stephanie in Houston, appreciate your call. Danielle Paquette, Eric Dean, Ellen Voya, please stand by. Harry Holzer joins us right now from Washington. He's professor of public policy at Georgetown University, former chief economist at the Labor Department in the Clinton administration. Harry, thanks for being here.
Nice to be with you.
I'm still trying to figure out exactly what's driving the need here. We've heard so much about the country needing more blue-collar jobs, but at the same time we're hearing you've got jobs going begging and millennials not stepping into them. I mean, you know, welcome women, have at the jobs, but how do you square that with the storyline that we don't have enough of these jobs and there's more demand than jobs in these sectors broadly, Harry?
There's different things going on in different places, okay, in different industries. So, you know, first of all, the economy has finally fully recovered from the Great Recession. So demand is strong. And as was indicated earlier, you've had baby boomers retiring. You've had less educated men dropping out of the workforce for other reasons. So you're starting to have this very tight labor market. And in some places, in some industries, like construction, like truck driving, you have shortages in some places because of that combination of factors. But, we're a big country, and we have a lot of different regional labor markets. So you go to former manufacturing towns, you know, think of the Dayton, Ohio's, or the Allentown, Pennsylvania's.
Yep.
In those places, you don't have a worker shortage. You know, there is a shortage of jobs. And the people who have continued to live in those areas still have trouble finding work. Whereas you go to other regions, you know, more booming regions on the coasts, the big metro areas, there the economy is much stronger, the demand is much greater for workers. And that's where employers and key industries are going to have the opposite pressure. Trouble filling the jobs that are available.
Eric Dean, General President of the Ironworkers Union, are all the jobs that fall under your union's purview open to women, good for women? What kind of jobs do you represent?
Well, we represent the people who build our nation's skyscrapers, roads, bridges, major industrial projects, commercial construction projects, and we also do fabrication of the products that we actually construct on the site. And every one of those is welcoming to women. The demand, as far as the opportunity for us, we have pockets of places where there has been a regression in the economy, but like the previous guest has spoken to, our issues are more along the line of construction spending is at an all-time high. So while there may be a national manufacturing shortage, there's a construction demand. So we're attempting to meet demand. We've always been a supply and demand business where our apprenticeship programs, we put people through the pipeline and deliver them just in time as the market increases in demands.
Are you putting women into jobs that immigrants might have filled and they're now disappearing as the government cracks down on all that?
Well, we compete against an immigrant workforce, a domestic workforce. Our members don't judge by skin color nor any other matter. It's the ability to work hard and fulfill the collective bargaining arrangement on the job and give an employer that fair pay. And regardless of women or skin color, we haven't seen the immigrant factor increase our demand for women. We're doing it, A, because it's the right thing to do, and B, there's a global demand in the increase in construction spending. So I would say the economy improving has been the biggest market force on construction spending, and it's increased our demand to broaden our outreach.
Eric Dean with General President of the Iron Workers Union. Please stand by there. Ellen Voya, President of Women in Trucking Association, and Harry Holzer at Georgetown University, Danielle Paquette at the Washington Post. You've definitely got us into some interesting territory here. We really appreciate your joining us today. Terrific piece in the Washington Post. Listeners, you can link to it at our website. Danielle, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about traditionally male-dominated jobs, iron worker, truck driver, more, now being promoted to women as men retire or drift off from interest in those jobs. Eric Dean is with us. He's general president of the Iron Workers Union. Ellen Voya is here, president of Women in Trucking Association. Harry Holzer looks at the demographics of all this, former chief economist, the economics of it at the Labor Department during the Clinton administration. He's now professor at Georgetown University. And you can join us as well. Is that you, the new woman on the job site, or maybe not so new? Maybe you've seen it over time. Do you have more women in your ranks now? Matthew in Cincinnati, Ohio. Matthew, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment. I have a small farm in Ohio, and a couple things came up where I needed some help in the spring one year. So I put an ad out at a local agricultural college for an externship paid well above minimum wage.
Yep.
The only applicants I got were women.
And so what were they going to do for you, Matthew? What kind of work?
Farming, driving great big tractors in the field.
Yeah, good.
And the only applicants I got were women. So I picked the one that had the most experience and brought her out. And the biggest tractor she ever ran was 75 horsepower. And I put in a 400 horsepower tractor on a big field ripper.
Yeah.
And she did great. And she worked dawn to dusk. I brought her food and fuel. And she got the fields worked and planted and did a good job.
Did it change the way you think about the world? Did it change the way you think about hiring in the world, Matthew?
No, it didn't, because I grew up, my sister could run tractors,
yep.
My friends,
mine too.
Girls, they could run tractors.
Yep.
So it didn't really change the way I think, but I just thought it odd that the only applicants I got were women.
Yeah,
and men didn't even apply.
It is very interesting. Matthew, I appreciate your call from Cincinnati. Harry, I'm still trying to understand the millennial face of this. Why isn't another generation of guys or women either, but why aren't those guys stepping into these jobs, Harry?
Well, again, I think there's a lot of factors at play. A lot of millennials are looking for a white collar job and are enrolled in higher ed, or at least hoping for that. So to attract them to this kind of work, the wages would have to go way up, and even the wages may not be sufficient, because they have an image in their head, not of being a farm worker, but of being a professional of some type. So I think that makes it tougher in an industry like this. But we have a terrible additional problem in the country right now. A lot of less educated men have dropped out of the workforce. You know, after years and years, they expected there to be good paying manufacturing jobs.
Yep.
When those dried up, and again, especially in a lot of these regions, you know, these former manufacturing regions, a lot of these men simply left the labor force. A lot of them went on disability. There is an opioid epidemic in a lot of these areas that's really very disturbing. So, you know, in some places, a lot of the traditional sources of workers for this kind of industry have dried up for one reason or the other.
The opioid epidemic, is that hitting men harder than women, or more involved in that, caught up in that?
Of course, you do see it for both genders, but I do think it's hit men very hard. And again, I think this demographic, sort of young to middle-aged, less educated men facing a lack of work, especially a lack of good-paying work, they've been particularly susceptible to that problem.
Can women make up these differences of guys who have dropped out of the labor market and just maybe don't have an interest now or confidence in coming back, or those who've got, you know, can't pass the drug test? Can women fill the gap?
Well, women certainly help in a lot of these industries, like the ones we've been hearing about, like construction and truck driving. A lot of these industries are going to pay better than many of the lower wage service sector jobs that that these women have faced. So, yeah, they are a potential source of work. Now, again, you might have to do what some of our previous guests talked about. You might have to make paid family leave available. You know, women on average, since they still have more responsibility for families, you know, they would care a little more about those kinds of benefits, child care, paid family leave. You know, you'd have to provide more training. But then, of course, you know, you might, if wages go up and if a lot of these employers provide more of the training, you might start to bring men back in a lot of these fields, because, you know, the pay all of a sudden will look a lot better. The training will be provided. So that might make you more competitive with some of the men as well as some of the women.
Let me get Tammy in Madison, Wisconsin on. Hi, Tammy. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say I love your show, and as I work in a male-dominated field since 1978, I kind of just stumbled into working as a resident manager and then maintenance mechanic for apartment buildings in Madison.
Yeah.
And I had to teach myself how to do plumbing and electrical work and, you know, and was successful at it. But I didn't make the same wages that my male counterparts were making back in those days. And I wish that there was the same push to get women in those fields with the same benefits back then as there are now.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. Having been there since 1978, you're an original there, Tammy, and I appreciate your call. Thinking of that, Eric, I mean, do you have a little to look back on, Eric, and wonder if there were times when the union was not so supportive of women, your union included?
Well, I believe the construction trades were always a male-dominated trade.
Yeah.
And we recognized through civil rights and empowerment that we needed to be more diverse and more inclusive. And we're far better than we were. The national building trades, we have a lot of apprenticeship readiness programs addressing that very concern. But as far as my union goes, I knew that we were better than we were, but we needed to improve to get better yet.
How far do you think this is going to go as our demographics change here, as maybe millennials don't want to do some of these jobs, or maybe not in the same proportion as boomers? How far do you think the percentage that you're talking about, still under 10% maybe of your membership, where might it go?
Well, we're waiting to see the benefits of including this maternity benefit to see if we get a spike in women who are interested. But we also did it for the women who were members already to provide a benefit for them. I want to tell you that we don't have an issue recruiting people to these well-paying jobs, men or women. We're fighting the social stereotype where we stopped teaching shop in school. So we haven't inspired young people that there's a well-paying job career ahead of them if they want to work with their hands, pay attention in science and mathematics, and when they complete school, our training, our apprenticeship training is equivalent to an associate degree. So it's not a less educated field. There's a broad range that every building tradesperson goes through their progressive apprenticeship training. But for us, the opportunity is expanding the workforce and meeting the construction demand that's currently present as far as this construction spending increase goes. And it came out of nowhere. We went from 2008 with a construction economy that was less favorable, and now it rose like a phoenix.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ellen, what's your word for women out there listening and thinking, maybe that's for me?
Well, we have an image issue with the trucking industry because people just don't picture women in it. So I would say, you know, check us out. Make sure you do your homework. We'll look at the Women in Trucking website because we'll help provide funding. We have scholarships. We've created a Girl Scout transportation patch so that young girls can learn about careers in transportation and touch a truck and talk to a driver and see what the industry is like. So it's not what it used to be. It's much more technologically advanced. So I'd say check it out.
I love it. Girl Scout truckers, we are on the move here. Ellen Voya, president of Women in Trucking Association, with us from Waupaca, Wisconsin. Ellen, thanks very much for being here today.
Thank you, Tom.
Harry Holzer at Georgetown University, professor of public policy there. Professor Holzer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Eric Dean, no less than the general president of the Iron Workers Union, with us from Naples, Florida. Eric Dean, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, Canada and the U.S. at loggerheads over lumber imports. This is On Point. We'll be right back. A long, simmering trade dispute between Washington and Ottawa, the Canadian capital, has broken out into an open spat. The Trump administration says it's slapping tariffs of up to 24% on certain kinds of Canadian lumber. Canada's foreign minister, Chrystia Freeland, warned yesterday that hockey is her country's national sport, and they are set to fight hard on the tariff issue. For more, we turn to Andrew Maeda in Washington. He's a trade and global economics reporter for Bloomberg News. Andrew, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What's at the heart of this fight over lumber imports to the U.S.?
Well, as you mentioned, the U.S. recently imposed a duty of up to 24% on Canadian lumber coming across the border. And I think it's important to remember that, as you mentioned in your intro, this is a long-standing dispute. It actually goes back to 1982. It's gone back and forth for a very long time. And what it comes down to is that Canadian lumber firms pay fees to Canadian provinces, which actually own the trees. And the U.S. argues that the fees that the Canadian lumber firms pay are too low and therefore constitute an unfair subsidy. Canada says that's not true, and it's been going back and forth for 25 years.
Wait, maybe I'm dense, but I'm not following this. Who pays fees to the provinces, and what's the logic of that in the first place? Why are they paying? I mean, somebody's paying for the lumber already, right?
The Canadian provinces, for example, British Columbia.
Yeah, like our states, yeah.
Own the trees.
They're from public land? Is that what you mean?
Correct. It's crown land.
Okay. Right?
So when a company like West Fraser, produces lumber, it cuts down the trees and it pays the Canadian province. These are called stumpage fees.
Okay, you call it a fee, but this is what they're really paying for the wood that's coming out of the forest.
That's right.
Okay, and
they
call it a fee, and the American claim is that they're selling this lumber too cheaply.
That's right. And Canada says, first of all, that the U.S. doesn't take into account all of the fees, all of the money that Canadian companies pay, and secondly, that the duties, the retaliation, is too harsh.
Okay. What about the prices of Canadian lumber? How do they compare with American lumber? And I don't know what the best point of comparison is. Is it currently a lot cheaper than American lumber?
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of a supply and demand thing. The Canadian lumber has been flowing across the border for years. In fact, probably a lot of your listeners, if you have a mattress at home, there's a good chance there's Canadian lumber in it.
Yeah.
If you own a house, there's a good chance there's Canadian lumber in it. So Canada has ample supply of trees. I mean, that's definitely one thing that country has. And so yes, they're able to produce them at lower prices, and they've been shipping lumber into the U.S. under NAFTA for years.
What has the impact of that been on American timber folks and lumber industry?
Well, the timber industry in general has not been doing great. But that has to do not just with trade with Canada, but with the global demand for wood. It has to do with the structure of the global lumber industry. But certainly the American lumber industry has been arguing for a very long time that this costs them revenue, it costs their companies jobs, and it is hurting the industry.
Here's President Trump yesterday firing a salvo at Canada over what he called unfair trade deals, announcing these new tariffs on Canadian lumber.
We will be putting a very big tariff on timber coming into this country. People don't realize Canada has been very rough on the United States. Everyone thinks of Canada as being wonderful, and so do I. I love Canada. But they've outsmarted our politicians for many years.
President Trump yesterday, and here was Canada's Natural Resources Minister, Jim Carr, at a press conference in Ottawa, saying Washington's tariffs will harm Canadians and Americans.
These unfair and punitive duties will negatively affect people's jobs on both sides of the border and will ultimately increase costs for American families who want to build or renovate homes.
Andrew Maeda with Bloomberg News. What are the politics of this? Of all the bars in all the world, why is the administration going after Canadian lumber?
Well, there's interesting politics on both sides of the border on this. For Donald Trump, this is an opportunity for him to look tough on trade. He hasn't implemented a lot of his promises in the first 100 days. If you recall, on the campaign trail, he said he would declare China a currency manipulator. He didn't do that. Secondly, it's not even manipulating the currency, but he didn't do that.
Right.
He said that he would launch, he would renegotiate NAFTA. He called it a disaster of agreement. He has yet to relaunch negotiations. So he's taking aim at Canada on dairy and softwood lumber. You know, and it's a pretty easy mark. I think that if he were to level these types of charges against the Mexicans, I think things could get pretty incendiary pretty quickly. But I mean, Canada and the U.S. have the largest trading relationship in the world, traditional allies going back decades. So the relationship will survive this. I mean, the politics on the other side of the border is, I can say this as a Canadian, is that the surest way to score points in Canadian politics is to beat up on the Americans. So in a way, this
easy plays, targets for everybody here.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of straw men here on both sides. I think that this is all a very noisy prelude to the NAFTA negotiations. That's when we're really going to see what each country is willing to is going for, what offensively they are trying to get from the negotiations,
yeah.
But also what they're willing to concede.
Andrew, will Canada hit back somehow on this in trade terms? And what about it? Will this make American homes, new ones, more expensive?
Well, on your second point, it's interesting if you look at the market price of softwood lumber over the past few months, it certainly has been rising. The background to it is that there was an agreement between Canada, a detente, if you will, in October between the two sides. Ever since that agreement expired, softwood lumber prices have been increasing. So yeah, it's certainly affecting the market. In terms of how Canada can retaliate, I mean, look, you're talking about an economy about a tenth the size of the United States of America, the biggest economy in the world. I mean, Canada doesn't really have a lot of weapons. It's an open trading nation.
Yep.
There's not a lot of there's not a lot of things that Canada could do. I mean, you know,
we got to cut it right there, Andrew. But you are terrific, Andrew Maeda with Bloomberg News. Detente off when it comes to lumber, the U.S. and Canada tariffs coming on. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.